This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
While we're talking about the internet, that's actually what our next story is about, because of protests, for example, specifically the one that's been happening in Hong Kong, the mega protest, we're looking at the role that social media plays in all of this. Because Hong Kong's anti-government protests over the past few days and their successful organization is hugely down to, in many ways, social media and messaging apps.
So, for example, Telegram's influence became very apparent when an administrator of a 30,000-strong group on Telegram was arrested. Several other major social media platforms like Twitter and Instagram and even Twitch, usually used to stream live stream video games, were used to broadcast what was happening on the ground.
Facebook and Twitter have been around for a while in this game, and it is still being used to share news about the current protests, which is, of course, focusing on the upcoming extradition bill. But a lot of the sensitive information sharing and coordination, the where, what, why, how this is going to happen, has actually moved on to other apps, Telegram and Signal.
And that's also because of increasing concerns about privacy and security, which has also leaked into the offline world as well. Protesters have been advised to stop using public Wi-Fi, to protect their ID cards, passports and bank cards by wrapping them in aluminium. The latter is to protect against RFID scanners.
China, on their own apps like Weibo, have gone out to censor anything related to the protests. Terms like "Let's go, Hong Kong" have been subject to the country's Great Firewall. And yesterday, Telegram was also subject to cyber attacks with IP addresses originating from China. Obviously, this isn't the first time that social media has played a role in an uprising. I'm sure we remember things like the Arab Spring, for example. But also, even in our own country, when it comes to Bersih, Facebook was hugely important. You know, WhatsApp was hugely important in making that possible.
Yeah, it was so many Facebook groups. It was so many WhatsApp groups even. And I think what's interesting about what's happened with movements getting organized and getting started over messaging and social media apps is the fact that most of these movements eventually become one where there is no leader. It becomes a collective. And I guess that's overall become a more effective method of protesting, simply because there isn't just one person that either gets the brunt of the praises or gets the brunt of criticism.
Yes, and when you are a big anonymous mass, it's a lot harder to target. Yeah, exactly. On the subject, I think, of memes as well, because we are also seeing expressions come out of dissent even in places like China, usually taking the form of internet speak, which is why when you were saying earlier that sometimes politicians haven't updated their game, I think that it's quite relevant in spaces online where you don't even recognize sometimes that you're being made fun of. You don't even recognize that somebody is actually expressing a sarcastic opinion about you because they are using a meme, they're using a hashtag, they're using a term that you didn't identify. And that is an interesting growth that's been occurring in certain countries too.
Yeah, as well as locally. Of course, I don't want to mention specific names here, but there have been slightly more successful attempts with older politicians when they try to create hashtags of their own and so on. But it is true.
And then they steal terminology from East Malaysia.
Which wasn't meant to be what it was meant to be here. So it is an interesting move to use memes as a way to protest something. And the kind of humor that's associated with it also seems to be a generational gap between this kind of humor that's expressed in them and how the other group understands them as well.
I really enjoy seeing that. We're crossing over now to get a better handle on all of this to Nikki Cheong, media researcher with the University of Nottingham, UK. Nikki, thanks for joining us on the show.
No, thanks for having me.
So how have we seen the use of social media change and develop when it comes to the role it plays in protests and uprisings?
I think the changes we've seen, and really we really started talking about like 10 years, right? Because obviously I think the conversation started a lot with the Arab Spring and what happened in Egypt and Tunisia and those kind of things. The platforms are mostly still the same. We're still talking about Facebook. We're still talking about Twitter. And like you mentioned earlier, I think there is a shift definitely into chat groups. I don't think that this is very much about using the technology differently. I think people are just going to where they can find their audience and the mass crowd which they need. So if you want to kind of make more awareness and reach out to the public, you probably use kind of Facebook if the country, if Facebook is very popular in the country. But if you're trying to mobilize and you're trying to get a whole lot of people who you already have kind of like a focus group, then you go to kind of chat apps where groups already exist who are people who are already interested in kind of being mobilized for certain things.
Now, in countries like China and South Korea, we've seen the rise of the use of specific hashtags that bring people together and drive movements across social groups. Are hashtags truly useful as a sort of rallying cry?
Yeah, I mean, I think that hashtags serves a lot of different purposes, starting off, you know, obviously for search, right? So it really does allow people to kind of find out what's happening. And if they already know something is happening and they want to look for more information, hashtags work really well to kind of bring people in. It's almost like an indexing feature. But I think we've also seen kind of internationally kind of how hashtags have been used to kind of rally people together. So hashtags like Me Too, for example, which was used against kind of a lot of women's rights activists in the US against kind of inappropriate sexual assault and sexual harassment. We've seen how that incident appropriated an existing hashtag, which was a Me Too hashtag, to kind of bring people to get them to share their own stories and things. But I think kind of hashtags are very, very fascinating, right? Because I think different people, and you've mentioned before, like even in Malaysia, people are using it kind of like for more marketing, promotional purposes. We've seen hashtag being appropriated for different things. And they're basically doing the same thing. They're calling out to people. They're making people aware that certain things are happening. But it's just really kind of the context in which it's being used. So obviously, with protests, rally cries are really great use of hashtags because, number one, everybody recognizes what a hashtag is these days. You know, if you see the hashtag, you know that, okay, this is a social media thing. We know we can find it. Hashtags work really well because it works across platforms. So hashtags can work on Facebook, can work on Instagram, they can work on Weibo, they can work on Twitter. So you can actually use it in different ways. So I think that's why people have tended to kind of gravitate towards hashtags.
And to take a closer look at somewhere like China, where social media is subject to government control, how do protesters keep up with or challenge this control within their movements? I think here I'm speaking specifically about things like internet speak and how the fact that sometimes authorities haven't been able to keep up or can't keep track of the kinds of language that people use on social media, how has that played into this whole idea of being able to dodge authorities?
Yeah, and I think, you know, I think that this comes down to any kind of countries where censorship is being used, right? Because the only way you can censor things is by preempting what you want to censor. So, for example, so in Malaysia, we have this kind of things where on television and things, you have a 15-second delay, right, of a live show, so you can kind of block it. In China, they kind of use keywords with the Great Firewall to kind of identify what kind of things can come in and can't come in. I think because it's always preemptive, you have it's susceptible to people who are creative. So again, just going using the example I gave you just now with the Me Too movement, when the Me Too movement tried to come into China, for example, China could block it out in advance because they saw this kind of movement, this swell happening in a foreign country. But what they couldn't pick up so quickly was the way that it was appropriated by the Chinese citizens to circumvent the censorship, right? Because we all know how it works. So they started using the hashtag Rice Bunny, which is Me Too in Mandarin, which is basically sounds like Me Too. It's a completely different word. I mean, like rice and bunny makes no sense. But it's a very clever way of speaking to the same hashtag and the same movement, but in a way that will work around the censorship rules. And, you know, China will continue doing that. They will, the moment they find this happening, they will block it. And then they just find different ways of being clever with it. And it's just a game of, like, you know, catching per se. So I think that's why hashtags are also really useful, because you can put any words in there, right? And you can use symbols and you can do anything to kind of make it different from what it is, but still give people enough context to understand that this is what we're talking about.
Which then brings into the picture the use of memes as a form of counterculture. For instance, Winnie the Pooh or Peppa Pig in China. How have the use of memes developed for this purpose, and why is it as effective as it is?
Yeah, but I think, you know, memes are not specific to, I mean, we're talking specifically images, right? But memes, the whole idea of memes is that it's things that are replicated. So a hashtag can be memified in that sense. What you're talking about in terms of Peppa the Pig and Winnie the Pooh, so obviously Winnie the Pooh, when we're talking about China, we're talking very specifically to the fact that it's associated to the president, Xi. And what happened with this one was that it was just kind of a joke that started in the beginning. It was Obama and President Obama and President Xi meeting up. So it was like Pooh and Tigger. So something that's funny just becomes viral the way any kind of jokes would happen. It's then, again, coming back to appropriation. You appropriate it into the political context to make fun of the president, right? So these kind of things are not... I don't think anybody sets out to create a meme that will do that. I think we definitely see those things happening in politics in terms of promotional culture, where they're trying to promote themselves, either using a hashtag or an image to kind of make themselves look more cool and down with the times. But if we're thinking about it very specifically with protests, it's usually very organic, that it comes on somebody, a satirical piece that somebody might have written or a picture that somebody might have made, a manipulation to an image. And then this thing just go viral on its own because it takes a life. When it takes a life of its own, then it can, when it's placed within the protest, it just mobilizes people in an easier way, because the same thing as a hashtag, it just brings people together because they know that these are people who are sharing these are their, you know, if you're going to use a Chinese term, their comrades.
And bringing it back to the situation in Hong Kong then, where live streaming is being used to broadcast events as they happen, which we also saw in the Arab Spring, have these platforms then replaced media in some ways and traditionally trusted news sources as just a quicker, more reliable source of information coming directly from the ground?
Yeah, I mean, I would hesitate to use the word replace, because I think that, mainstream media still have its role. But I think definitely we've seen the way that social media and the kind of the pace and the ability to scale up really quickly, right? So the virality and all those kind of things that we talk about can be used. I mean, if we think about what's happening in Hong Kong at the moment, for example, it's very fascinating, because what the use of kind of like Telegram and, you know, that you mentioned earlier in the introduction is actually not very unique to protests of 2019. In 2011, for example, in the UK, there was the London riots, which was labeled the BlackBerry riots, because people did exactly the same thing. They used BlackBerry to mobilize themselves. And because BlackBerry was a private chat space, the authorities couldn't catch up with it as quickly as they would if it was on Twitter or on Facebook, where things are a bit more public. So they can only find people after the event and not before. And that's exactly the same thing that's happening with Telegram. I think these private spaces are being used because they exist and they can do what you want to do. But it's not actually... so unique that just because these things exist now, therefore we are all gravitating to there. It only happens because people are on it already. I do want to say one thing is that protest movements and stuff, sometimes when you have the big crowd, right, you can kind of push this shift. So this happened in Hong Kong when they had the umbrella movement a few years ago, where they relied on things like fire chat, where they specifically, people started downloading that because they found that fire chat allows access to the internet on a peer-to-peer basis, which means that people who was having trouble kind of connecting to their data could rely on that app, which used a different technology to get access to the internet. So I think that what's happening is people are actually finding, I mean, based on what we're talking today, I think people are just finding different ways to use technology to adapt to what they need, and at times adapt to what the technology can do to kind of serve kind of the different purposes that they're trying to achieve.
Nikki, thank you so much for speaking with us today.
No worries. Thank you for having me.
That was Nikki Cheung, media researcher with the University of Nottingham, UK, weighing in on the role of social media when it comes to organizing and getting organized in terms of protests and uprisings. Laif Yuzal says, I'm so happy to see how social media can be such a powerful tool against tyranny. Keep it up, Hong Kong, and don't bend the knee.
Well, the other end of it is also while it has been a liberating tool in terms of politics, it also has been a slightly dangerous one. We've seen in India where they had to take efforts to, for WhatsApp at least, they had to take efforts to stop people from being able to forward so many messages to too many groups of people simply because it was inspiring a lot of mob attacks.
Yes. So it cuts both ways. You're absolutely right. Send those thoughts through. You can WhatsApp us 018-789-8899. Tweet us at BFM Radio. Also, after the 7:30 news today, it's going to be Skip Intro. Julian and Ian will be in and they'll be talking about Men in Black International before we talk about Men in Black as a whole. Keep it here on the Evening Edition, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my, BFM 89.9, the business station.